Morning.
May it please the court, I want to start by clarifying a factual point that may be relevant to the order that the court issued last week. Two of the states in which the plaintiffs reside, Arizona and Tennessee, do not currently have any stocks of sodium thiopental. So the order banning FDA from exercising enforcement discretion with respect to future imports of thiopental would materially affect and probably eliminate the possibility that those states could obtain thiopental and use them in an execution in the future. And for that reason, we're not contesting the plaintiff's standing on the grounds of redressability. The Rule 19 issues that were raised in the amicus brief to which the court directed our attention related to existing stocks of thiopental. The district court's order had instructed FDA to send out a notice advising the states that they needed to return thiopental to FDA. We think that that aspect of the court's injunction was error for a number of reasons, but...
Well, plaintiffs didn't request it, did they?
It was in the complaint.
Right.
It in the complaint?
There was one among the relief in the request was that FDA take steps to recover thiopental, but... Well, we have not sought emergency relief with respect to that aspect of the order, and we've complied with it. We sent out a notification for the states. So we don't believe that the issue of whether that was correct is currently before the court, and so we haven't set
the court below did not have jurisdiction to issue that order, and I don't see where it came from. Wouldn't we have an obligation to vacate that part of the order?
Well, we think that it's moot at this point because we've complied with it, and we thus haven't appealed it. And also, I'm not sure that the problem with the order is a jurisdictional one. The problem with the order is it...
Where would the court get the authority to issue that order?
I don't think the district court had the authority to issue that order.
It's a jurisdictional problem for the district court then, isn't it?
We had been conceiving it as a merits problem, but I think you could...
You just admitted the court... I don't care to consider it an admission since you probably shouldn't want them to, but... You just stated the court did not have the authority to issue the order, right?
Yes.
The states were not before it. States were not before the court, right?
That's correct.
There's nothing in the statutes that are cited to us that says the court can do this.
Right.
So it would appear the court exceeded its jurisdiction, wouldn't it?
Yes
would be an easy answer for your.
Well, I'm not here.
I've never seen anybody who's reluctant to win.
I'm not here to debate the point. We think that
you are here to answer my question. You need to answer that one.
I don't think Rule 19 has historically been treated as jurisdictional. I think that it's an issue that the courts often reach without being
Rule 19 problem. The court, the states were not there, but if they had been there, there's still nothing that. Is cited to us, it gives the court the authority to do what the court did here, isn't it?
I agree with that.
Okay.
I'll turn to the
yes,
merits.
Would have been shorter.
perhaps. I'll turn to the merits of the ban on the exercise of enforcement discretion. In Heckler versus Cheney, the Supreme Court recognized the general principle of enforcement discretion of federal agencies, and in the particular context, as it happens. Of lethal injection, that exercise of enforcement discretion has been uniformly recognized both in the domestic context, as in Heckler, but also historically in the importation context. FDA.
What about the January 2011 policy?
That policy was new because the issue of states importing thiopental was a new one because of the. Because the domestic manufacturer stopped manufacturing thiopental. But the legal question that the district court resolved is not limited to the importation of thiopental for lethal injection. The district court's conclusion was that whenever an article is offered for import that violates, in fact, whether or not the FDA makes a formal determination to that effect, the statute that the FDA has to take action, and that has never been the way this has been understood.
Okay,
FDA,
back up with me for a moment. As to the January policy, even if the district court went beyond that and came into the realm of Heckler v. Cheney enforcement discretion, courts have held that a policy, an enforcement policy, isn't, jurisdiction isn't barred by that doctrine. That's what I'm trying to get at. And what's your position on that?
Well, there's two problems with that in this particular case. One is that the policy that we're talking about, if you're going to call it a policy, I'm not sure that that's
whatever you want to call it. January 2011 statement right. by FDA that this was its policy.
Right. That mirrors extremely closely the policy that was at issue in Heckler versus Cheney itself. FDA declared in the domestic context in Heckler versus Cheney that it was not going to take enforcement action with respect to drugs that were being used for lethal injection. And that, in Heckler itself, was not considered to be a policy that was subject to judicial review. The other related point is that the district court's holding here was an interpretation of the substantive provisions of the statute, or of the at least the Section 381 of Title 21, and the district court's holding was that FDA has no discretion, and you can't limit that holding to thiopental. And FDA, in the context of personal imports, as we noted in our brief, since 1954, has exercised enforcement discretion. FDA has repeatedly presented to Congress statements and other indications that FDA was exercising enforcement discretion in the importation context, in the context of drug shortages, in the context of importations for personal use. And Congress's response has been to enact legislation that contemplates that FDA is exercising enforcement discretion.
Clear. The district court wasn't ruling on a personal use claim. So shouldn't we read his order in that light?
The order doesn't cover personal, or it may or may not cover personal.
It wasn't before the district court.
But the arguments that the district court accepted would apply equally to other contexts. The district court's conclusion was that the word shall.
But a court might hold, well, Congress has already made that determination, that there's this exception for personal use.
Well, but Congress hasn't enacted a statute that says there's an exception for personal use, or there's an exception for drug shortages, or there's an exception for anything. What Congress has done has fully aware that FDA is exercising discretion in those areas and perhaps other areas as well, has enacted statutes that say, oh, here's how you should exercise your enforcement discretion.
What is there to tell us that was a ratification of existing policy rather than a newly granted discretion?
There's a few things. One is it doesn't, the language of these enactments that I'm talking about don't reflect that they're granting discretion. They say things like they should use their discretion, or when they're using their discretion, they should consider these factors. The other thing is.
Well, wait a minute. That just sounds like a grant of new discretion.
Well, no, if they say, I mean, it doesn't say, for example, in these circumstances, FDA need not exercise its, you know, its enforcement power.
What exactly does it say in personal use?
The personal use one is of course, complicated because the particular statute hasn't taken effect because it's tied to the Canadian, the question of
importation. I'm not sure that diminishes the point one way or the other. What does it say? Does it say when exercising its essentially acknowledged discretion? I don't think so.
Let me find the exact language because I don't want to misstate
it. That's what I'm asking for. What's the section number?
It's 384J, and it says FDA should focus enforcement. And it's on page 36 of the blue brief we've quoted. It said FDA should focus enforcement on cases in which the importation by an individual poses a significant threat to public health and exercise discretion to permit individuals to make such importations.
Now, that's perfectly consistent with saying, although you had no discretion before, we want you henceforth to focus your enforcement on certain cases and exercise discretion as shown.
I think that would be a surprising way for Congress to accomplish that result, given that FDA had, and Congress was well aware of this, been exercising discretion in this regard for decades.
Well, okay, I asked you what there was to indicate that this was a ratification of discretion, and you pointed me to the wording of the statute, which doesn't do it. Now you're off to a pre-existing practice. So let's hear about that.
Well, it's a combination of things, but we've cited in our brief testimony that was presented to Congress, and indeed there's a statement from a legislator that we've cited in our brief where a legislator stated you know, in what he described as a vow to common sense, FDA for 40 years, this was a statement was in 2001, has not enforced the statute every time there is an importation.
Someone who's skeptical about the use of legislative history in general, a statement at a hearing is particularly weak. Is that all there is?
Well, no, that's an example, but FDA, I mean...
Any committee reports?
I'm not aware of a committee report that specifically discusses...
Any FDA submission to the committee?
Yes, we've cited some of those in our brief as well. They're quoted toward the end of the reply brief. There are submissions that FDA has exercised enforcement discretion, and there's also, I mean, we've cited in our brief a regulation or a preamble to a regulation relating to the investigational new drug procedures in which the question was raised whether when there's a drug shortage, FDA should rely on the investigational new drug procedures in order to allow. And what FDA said in the preamble to the rule, this is in 2009, was that FDA, in many instances, the investigational new drug procedures will not be feasible to use in those circumstances, and FDA will instead exercise enforcement discretion. If you look at the...
Although that's not the personal use discretion, is it?
No, we're not.
Another.
Right, and that.
I'm still looking at the personal use discretion. You said towards the end of the reply brief. And that is the personal use material is taken up at page 31 of the reply brief.
We've given some examples.
I've got a statement from a congressman here. But you said there was something that the FDA submitted.
On page 37 of the reply brief, there's testimony from 1998 that says FDA's enforcement discretion to release shipments, and this is a combination of the drug shortage and the personal use, it's sort of both in play at once, from unlicensed sources that are not covered by it discusses, we don't have the beginning of the sentence, but it says, it uses the words enforcement discretion, and it says when the quantity and purpose are clearly for personal use. That's 1998 testimony.
Whose testimony is it?
It's someone from HHS or FDA. I forget exactly. I don't want to be flipping through my brief up here. The other thing is there's the Regulatory Procedures Manual, which is cited by both parties in the brief, which has a section on personal importation.
I think all we saw was the citation to the current version of the manual.
That's
really want to know what the manual said prior to the grant of legislative authority.
What you're describing is the grant of legislative authority, which you know we interpret differently.
Whether it's a new grant or ratification,
right. But
you can't tell from looking at the current version of the manual.
Well, we could, and here's why: the provision that we're talking about, we're not saying it's a ratification in the sense that it says that FDA has enforcement discretion. The point we're making is that Congress has always presumed that FDA had enforcement discretion, and that provision is included in a section of the statute that only takes effect if the FDA makes certain findings, and FDA has not made those findings. So FDA could not be relying on that provision in its personal use determinations. It couldn't be relying on that provision because that provision has not taken effect. And so if, to the extent that anyone believes that FDA has discretion in the area of personal use or in the area of drug shortages, it must be the case that FDA has the discretion not under these new enactments, but under the statute that's always existed. And FDA has long exercised that discretion going back to 1954 in the context of personal use and going back over a decade at least in the context of drug shortages. And even apart from those two instances, there's no indication that FDA has ever, or Congress has ever construed the statute to require FDA to take enforcement action in every instance. There's just nothing, FDA...
Really addressing the word shall, you're addressing everything except that, but normally that's a mandatory expression from Congress. You are taking a position in your brief that shall doesn't mean shall here, but means may. I've not heard you say anything this morning that had a lot to do with that.
Well,
you just said Congress had not told them to do something, and it seems that it brings us back to if the word shall means shall, then it has.
Well, but if you look at the cases that involve agencies taking enforcement actions that use the word shall, you can start with the Heckler case itself, which involved a provision that used the word shall.
What did it say?
That was a criminal provision, and what it described, if you know certain facts are true, then the
shall there was in the consequential paragraph or sentence rather than in the action to be taken by the agency. That is to say, it was the penalty section, wasn't it?
Well, but I don't think this statute is much different. This says
it,
says the drug shall be refused admission. That's a consequence of the agency taking an action.
The agency, what it shall do. Or in the other one, it's talking about what the consequences were after the rest of the proceeding had already been conducted.
Well, I mean, it's not phrased in terms of what the agency shall do, but it also you can look at other cases. You can look at the environmental cases that we've cited in our brief from another circuits, which
the best parallel to this one.
Well, some of the cases we've cited in our brief have statutes of the form. If the secretary finds that, and then it lists out a condition, he shall, and then it lists a consequence. Those have uniformly been construed as not requiring action by the agency. In this court's decision in Her Majesty the Queen, it said, whenever the administrator has reason to believe that certain circumstances are true, he shall, and then a certain consequence. That was not construed by this court to be mandatory in order to make the predicate findings. Now here, what we're talking about is if it appears. And that's very similar to if the agency has reason to believe. It's not directed specifically at the agency, and that might be yet another reason that you would not read it in a mandatory way. But
to whom might it appear other than the agency?
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about the shall part. It says the article shall be refused admission. It doesn't say the agency shall take the following steps.
Refused by admission by whom?
Right, but in the same, all I'm saying is that it describes in the same way that the Heckler provision described the consequences to the violator, this describes the consequences to the drug. And I'm not disputing who would carry this out, although it does happen that Customs as well as FDA has a role in carrying it out. But the more fundamental point that I'm making is that in all of these instances, there is a predicate in which there's a discussion of, you know, where an agency, in order for the consequences to follow, would have to make a determination. And then there's a consequence that follows if the agency does make the determination. And these statutes shouldn't be read to require.
Where then are you saying the agency exercises its discretion in this instance?
So it makes
in deciding whether it appears or in deciding whether or not to take action after it appears.
Deciding whether or not to take action in the form of a formal determination that it appears. In the Her Majesty the Queen case that I discussed earlier, the administrator of EPA had sent letters to Congress in which the administrator expressed the view that the statutory prerequisites for action had been met. But the administrator did not reduce that to a formal determination that the prerequisites had been met. And therefore, this court held that the consequences that would follow from such a determination were not mandatory in that instance.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, please.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Eric Chomsky for the plaintiff appellees. Judge Sentell, let me start by addressing at least briefly the Rule 19 issue. I do agree with my
more than a Rule 19 issue. Even if the states were present, where does the court get the authority to issue that order? What statute are you operating under that allows the court to order the state, anybody, to give up drugs that are already out there?
Well, I think, and I want to be clear at the outset, I'm not going to resist too hard on this point, Your Honor. I think...
That sounds circumspect on your part.
I will...
You're exercising counselatory discretion on that one.
Counselatory discretion, there's no shall that says that I can't do that, unlike Section 381A. I think that the authority for it would be in a provision like Section 334. Those provisions of the FDCA are the ones that would provide that having or importing the drug would be illegal. So the problem, to the extent,
one thing and having is another. And aside from the states not being before the court, it looked like you're under importing statutes, and the court's importing an authority to chase the drugs out through the country and run them back up.
Well, again, Your Honor, I fear this discussion is a bit of an academic one. I do think that the agency and the court would have jurisdiction because under the seizure provisions, the importation of the illegal drug would mean that there's the ability to seize. And so if there were a problem, it would have been a Heckler-style problem, which isn't jurisdictional. But I think the short answer here is that that limited aspect of the relief clearly could be vacated while affirming the remainder of the judgment. So this doesn't seem to me something that
you would reaffirm that there are two states involved that do not have an existing supply.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. I'd also just note, and I don't know that we need to rely on this here for that reason, California, which is the third state, isn't currently performing lethal injection, and it is in the record that all of the thiopental that California had expires in about a year with something like 700 inmates on death row. So I think that the standing arguments, even as to the California plaintiffs, are pretty strong ones, but there certainly is at least one plaintiff withstanding here, which, of course, is all that's required. So turning to the Heckler issues, the long and the short of it is that Heckler didn't write FDA a blank check. The Supreme Court said in Heckler at 333, Congress did not set agencies free to disregard legislative direction in the statutory scheme that the agency administers. And that is absolutely what happened here. For the reason that you indicated, Judge Sentel, and going to your question, Judge Ginsburg, the statute says shall, and as you said, shall usually means shall. And there is no question here but that the agency recognized exactly what was going on. In November of 2010, FDA's deputy commissioner said, quote, there are no approved or permitted foreign sources of sodium thiopental. That's in the joint appendix at 94. Joint appendix 787, FDA director of import operations. FDA has been asked to allow the importation of an unapproved drug. Joint Appendix 140 and 163 are notices of FDA action that were issued that state in clear terms that the first shipment and the second shipment appear to be in violation, the first for misbranding, the second because it appeared that there was an unapproved new drug. Under those circumstances, where the appearance standard has been satisfied, FDA doesn't have discretion. The statute says that the drug, the product, shall be refused admission. I would note that until this case reached appeal, the principal argument that the government had made was that shall means may, and the heavy focus of the arguments was an interpretive principle or a claimed interpretive principle that shall means something other than shall in the enforcement context, and that's clearly not right. Heckler itself, reaffirming the Supreme Court's decision in Dunlop, makes clear that there's no such interpretive principle by which shall has a special meaning. In enforcement statutes, and this Court's decision in Armstrong makes pretty clear that there is no such rule. Even if there were such a rule, this is a pretty extraordinary statute. This is not just one use of the word shall. If you look at Section 381, by our count, there are 77 shalls, 54 mays, and somewhere, depending on how you want to tally them, between five and a dozen unlesses or accepts. And unless what Congress was intending to do here was to use words utterly at random, and Congress normally isn't presumed to write statutes in that way, there has to be some meaning given to the carefully reticulated way in which Congress put this statute together.
If it said that, which it, I understand it does not, if it said the commissioner believes that the putative import is improperly labeled, it shall be excluded. Would that not be a may, even though it says shall?
There are certainly some cases that suggest that when the statute is phrased in terms of the government official's subjective belief, for instance, and I believe we've seen some cases where...
So it exudes discretion.
That's exactly right, phrase, Judge, right? Ginsburg.
When we deal with if it shall appear, it has to appear to some human being. does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who would that be?
Well, I think it would have to appear to the government official. What we have here, though...
It's not the customs agent who makes the first determination that this is out of the... that this requires some sort of further inspection, is it?
I think that's right, and I think...
Because that's a computer, really.
Right, and I think that's the nub of it, and I think there's sort of a legal component to the answer and a factual component. Legally, if it appears, seems to me to be an objective standard that has within it or has surrounding it some room for discretion. This is not a statute like some of the ones that say, if such and such an official believes or if a government official determines in an exercise of their discretion.
That would be easier.
That would be a lot easier. The other thing that we have here are undisputed facts. And it's not only the statements that I was quoting a moment ago from the FDA Deputy Commissioner and the Director of Import Operations, but the actual notices that were issued at JA 140 and 163. And there are actually additional...
Those notices related to two particular shipments. I'm not sure I'm right with JA. I'm thinking of your paragraphs 37 and 42 in your complaint. Right? Each one recounts a shipment being stopped on different grounds, one for misbranding, I think, and one for something else. As to those two shipments, arguably it appeared to somebody that something was amiss.
Correct, Your Honor.
Are those two shipments still in play?
Those two shipments are not still in play.
Okay, so to whom did anything, limiting the universe to what's still alive, what states are still in play? What is there to say that it appeared to anyone?
So let me walk you through a couple of different incidents here. So the first two notices, and I don't want to lean on them too heavily for the reason you indicate, Your Honor. Those were the initial notices that indicated that there were apparent violations, and those two shipments are not...
Just the computer kicked it out? Is that all it means?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
In those two instances, it just means the computer kicked it out?
I believe that's right. There then were three more shipments, and those are in the joint appendix, I believe it's 783.
Excuse me, I'm corrected in one respect. It was not in the complaint. It was in your statement of undisputed facts, which remained undisputed.
That's exactly right.
And they were Georgia and Arkansas.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And then there were three more shipments that are identified at JA 753. Those three shipments are entries that were, quote, recommended for detention. That's also a term of art in FDA lingo, and the Regulatory Procedures Manual at Sections 9-6 and 9-7 makes clear that for something to be recommended for detention, the appearance standard needs to be met.
And by whom? Who makes the recommendation?
I don't know, and I don't know that it's in the record who issued the particular recommendation under those circumstances, but again, it is clear from FDA's manual that for that recommendation to issue, the appearance standard needs to be met.
This is on 753?
I believe so, Your Honor. Let me...
Say the page number again, please.
Make sure I'm not leading you astray.
I'm at 753, which is a notice of FDA action starting on 751. And page 3 is 753.
Right, so 753 of the joint appendix... This is the guidance document that FDA issued. This is the document, Judge Rogers, to which you were alluding.
Is it not part of the document at 751? Mm-hmm. Maybe not.
I believe it was attached to the document at 751, but the guidance begins on 752.
Okay.
And if you see at the top of 752, it says guidance for handling pending and future shipments of sodium thiopental. So the chronology here is these two shipments come in, the computer flags them, and this is sort of the fundamental point I want to get to. The computer flags them because it's undisputed and indisputable that every shipment of sodium thiopental that conceivably could be presented for admission to the United States today and for the foreseeable future, in fact, not just appears to violate the statute, but actually violates the statute, as the government conceded below. In their briefing, I believe it's docket 13-1 at page 19, they said, here the article clearly appears to be an unapproved new drug. There is no approved sodium thiopental, period. So what happens here is these two...
I understand that, but they're making the claim that unless they initiate a proceeding, they haven't made the appearance determination.
Right, Your Honor. So to answer your question directly, two shipments come, they get flagged with the notices, a series of further shipments are presented. FDA starts trying to figure out what to do with all of this, and that's the emails that I was quoting a moment ago, where they clearly are recognizing there are no approved or permitted foreign sources. Everyone knew what the right answer here is. This document then gets issued in January 2011, and as the title indicates, it was guidance for handling pending and future shipments. So it says, here's how we're going to deal with the pending shipments. And I misspoke. I said three entries. There are two on page 753 that were recommended for detention. It's not clear on the face just of this document, but you can match up the entry numbers. And one of those is the California shipment. The second one is. And so the appearance standard is met as to those under the terms of the regulatory procedures manual. But the nub of the problem, and again, Judge Rogers, this I think is where your question was going, is what FDA says on a going forward basis. It says, notwithstanding the fact that our computer told us and we knew that these drugs were not just apparently but actually in violation for a whole series of reasons. There are actually probably half a dozen different reasons that these drugs violate the terms of the statute. We're going to promulgate this guidance document that says how we're going to deal with this going forward. And the first thing that it says, and this is at 755 of the joint appendix, when an entry of sodium thiopental is identified, this is for all going forward cases, when an entry of sodium thiopental is identified, do not search the agency's databases to verify manufacturer's registration and listing information or the approval status of the drug. Knowing full well that there is no sodium thiopental that can come into the country consistent with Section 381, what FDA said is we're going to shut down the process, and we're going to shut it down in a way that prevents us from seeing the thing that Section 381 says is the most important thing to look at to trigger the statute, which is registration status.
If they have discretion in 381, then this is just a way of implementing it, isn't it? It's technically convoluted, but it's just a way of implementing that discretion.
If they have discretion to do nothing whatsoever, then this is a way...
We're going to give a pass to certain categories.
Then this would be a way of implementing that discretion.
So let's get to whether they have that.
And that gets to the question of whether they have discretion under the statute. Section 381A is, by our lights, pretty clear. It's useful, I think, to focus on the three different sentences that start off 381A and look at the way that the provision operates.
Do we need the second sentence for any reason?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do we need the second sentence, which was added in 62?
Yeah, the second sentence ends up being historically critically important. So what happens before 1962 is that the first sentence is the way a process gets initiated. FDA can ask for samples, and Customs has to provide them, and I use FDA and Customs as a shorthand. The statute speaks about Treasury and HHS, the secretaries to whom the agencies report. So FDA can ask for samples, and Customs has to provide them. And then, before 1962, the statute skips to the third sentence. If it appears from the examination of such samples or otherwise that designated conditions are met, then such article shall be refused admission. So prior to 1962, you had a world in which FDA is asking for samples, Customs has to give them. Now, of course, FDA is looking at these samples. It's not looking for the samples. It's not asking for the samples in order to get them and put them on a shelf. And it would be a pretty strange statute that says to Customs, when FDA asks you for a sample, you have to give it to them so that they can then go stick it in a warehouse and do nothing with it.
Well, so why, if they were operating under that provision, why not just not ask for samples, if that's all we had here?
And that was exactly the problem, and that's exactly what Congress was focused on in 1962. 1962, the thalidomide tragedy occurs, and Congress says this is not a good enough system. We can't just rely on FDA to decide whether to ask for samples. So in a limited, critically important universe of cases, Congress says, And this is the second sentence now, and this goes to your question, Judge Ginsburg, about whether this is important. FDA has to give customers a list of registered establishments. If there are items presented for import that aren't on the list, then samples have to be provided. I think the way it phrases it is that FDA has to ask for them, but that in conjunction with the first sentence means that they have to be provided. So Congress has now layered onto the old system this new special requirement that applies to the case of unregistered foreign facilities. This was especially important because registration was being newly established at the time. Section 360 sets up registration, and registration is the way that FDA gets facilities on its radar so that it knows to go out and inspect them. So now you have a statute that says, in sentence one, if FDA asks for samples, you got to provide them. In sentence two, where you're dealing with unregistered facilities, you have to provide a list in order to that customs will be able to determine whether things are coming in that are from unregistered facilities, and then you have to ask for samples of those. And then the third sentence of that kicks in, if it appears from the examination of such samples. And I think it's also useful to focus on the way that sentence is written. If it appears from the examination of such samples, it's the use of the definite article, the. It doesn't say if it appears from an examination. It doesn't say if FDA chooses to look. It doesn't say if FDA in its discretion decides to examine. If it appears from the examination, and in cases like ASARCO versus FERC in this court, say that the use of the term the typically means that there's some antecedent condition there.
NLRB, Noah Canning versus NLRB.
It did occur to me, Your Honor, that there have been other recent examples of the use of the definite article. I think that here all we have to do is look to ASARCO versus FERC. And then it goes on to say that the examination of such samples and such samples reaffirms that there's an antecedent there.
I take your point about the second sentence, which I was not fully didn't fully understand before, but. It seems to me that focuses the inquiry upon whether the FDA was openly and notoriously exercising discretion after 62 with congressional, not just acquiescence, but ratification in some way. Now, on the personal use policy, I believe there you made a point that the introduction of a special statute on special provision dealing with that required that the commission, before exercising the personal use policy, find it was in actual compliance. Is that what you said?
Are you referring to Section 384J, Your Honor?
G, I think.
Right. So there are two different provisions that I think speak to the personal use issue. There's 381G, which was enacted, I believe, in 2000 or thereabouts. And 381G is a specific statutory home for personal use. It's concededly a bit of an obscure provision, but it's pretty clear that the intent of it was to put a burden on FDA before it could exclude anything where personal use was at issue.
Well, here's what you said in your brief. Pardon me. Congress enacted into law findings disapproving of instances in which FDA had refused admission to personal imports of foreign medicines without informing, quote, the individual of the reasons underlying the decision to send the notice, close quote, and it dictated that FDA, quote, may not, close quote, take action after such importations unless FDA, quote, has made a determination that they actually violate the FDCA, had made a determination, in quotation marks. I don't read the statute that way. I think it's inaccurate.
I'm aware of the sentence in our brief to which you're pointing, Your Honor, and I think that it was inartfully phrased. I think that
it doesn't require that determination.
Well, it does require a determination. The notice specifies, I'm looking at 381G1A, the notice specifies as applicable to the importation of the drug that the secretary has made a determination that importation is in violation, and that's the language that we were focused on. You're certainly right, Your Honor, that the violation is because the drug is or appears to be.
Yeah.
And so
simply that it appears to be.
I agree, Your
Which
Honor.
Means that this little section doesn't add anything to the problem that we're trying to resolve.
Well, I think it does add something for a couple of reasons. One, Congress thought it was adding something, and so to the extent
we thought it was doing something to regularize and structure personal use importations.
And that's exactly.
But what it did was not, as described in the brief, to require a determination that's an actual violation.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But the point is, to the extent that we're talking about ratification here, it's hard to see a provision that creates a specific statutory home for personal use as being the thing that ratifies a supposedly pre-existing policy of free-floating enforcement discretion.
Well, it basically requires that notice be given, right? I mean, that's what it adds.
Well, it's actually sort of a strange form.
For some years, the Securities and Exchange Commission debarred some people from participating in the securities industry after certain types of violations. And this went on for quite a while, after which the Congress provided them with authority to do that, but set up certain procedural protections when they did. Right? So there was it's an analogous situation if the FDA is right here. Not that unusual.
So I would make two points in that regard, Your Honor. First, if you look at 381G2, which defines the term warning notice, it's pretty clear that this is very broadly meant to say that FDA can't even actually say anything to anyone about personal use unless they've made the determination specified in G1A. And so what FDA did here was it ratcheted up the sort of proof that's required before something could be excluded for personal use. And again, to the point about ratification, it at least creates a home for it. The other section that my friend on the other side
When was this added?
I believe it's 2000, Your Honor. So
the question would be still from the post 62 amendments until this, what was going on?
Right, and that gets to the question Your Honor asked about the sources that have been cited in the government's brief. And it would be a very strange theory of statutory interpretation that says, because there are a couple of drips and drabs in which someone goes up to the Hill.
Well, the someone was the deputy commissioner in the submission by the agency in one of these hearings.
Your Honor,
it wasn't just someone.
Well, I don't have any doubt that on some number of occasions over the years, FDA has said in a subcommittee hearing or in its own internal documents, which are some of the other things that are referred to here, we have enforcement discretion. It would be an unusual agency in this town that didn't say we have all kinds of authority. The question
well,
is,
since Chevron, they'd be right.
Of course, we're not in the realm of Chevron here.
Well, I'm not so sure, but I wouldn't get into why that might be, but that's a different question.
Well, it's certainly not an argument that the government has pressed other than in a sentence or so in their brief. There hasn't been any meaningful contention here that this policy guidance document merits Chevron deference. But in any event, Your Honor.
I'm not putting aside. Go ahead.
I think the fundamental point here is that where one needs to start, and Judge Sentelle, you made this point, is with the language of the statute. And a statute that says shall, to interpret it as imposing limitless enforcement discretion because on some handful of occasions an official, even a relatively senior official, has said...
It's not limitless. Discretion can be abused. They're claiming the discretion not to proceed when they have a reason to do so, such as a shortage of a particular drug or, in this case, a state role in the importation.
I suppose that's a fair point, Your Honor, and I overstated the scope of the discretion. I do think the point still holds, which is that the personal use policy would be a very strange way to say that the whole statute, with all of the shalls and mays and accepts, nonetheless carries this, if not limitless, quite broad ability just not to invoke it whenever the government feels fit. I'd like to make just a couple of very quick points about the personal use policy.
Way over.
I am way over, Your Honor.
No, I know. That's fine. But quick points?
My friend on the other side pointed to 384J. Of course, a statute that is, by the government's own lights, a dead letter because it hasn't been triggered is a very strange way to find a ratification of the use of discretion.
I don't see why that is. I mean, it's in there, and some predicate event hasn't occurred, but the predicate event doesn't reflect back on whether they are exercising or authorized to exercise discretion.
Well, and that's exactly the point. 384J doesn't show that there's any discretion. All it shows is that discretion would be okay if an event that hasn't occurred did occur. The other thing I just want to make clear about personal use is that, candidly, it just doesn't come up that much. And I want to reiterate, going back to the second sentence of 381A, we're only talking about the special and limited use of drugs from unregistered facilities. When someone comes across the border with a bottle of pills in their backpack, no one's looking at registration status because you typically can't tell about registration status. Customs has a whole different set of authorities under Title 19, Sections 1484 and 1498, that allow them to deal entirely differently with people carrying things across the border.
Okay, well, time being short, let me ask you this. Do you really want to maintain that the IND process is adequate to deal with drug shortages?
I think that there are at least five different statutory provisions that are adequate to deal with drug shortages.
Collectively. But not, I mean, your brief seems to suggest that the IND process is the key here.
I would point to two in particular. The IND process really is quite critical, actually. It's used all the time. And if you look at the regs in Part 312, there are individual INDs. They can be obtained by calling a telephone hotline. There are intermediate patient INDs.
Is determining that the drug and short supply now being sent from an unregistered source in a foreign country is, in any realistic sense, an investigational new drug? Or isn't it just a discretionary way of getting around a problem?
Well, the investigational new drug provisions have been interpreted broadly by FDA to let in drugs under any number of circumstances. In the mid-2000s, they used it to bring in 1.2 million doses of flu vaccine under an IND. INDs are available for individuals. They're available for 1.2 million people. They're available by telephone hotlines. This is FDA's view of the world, not mine. I'd also note
Now, don't we have a shortage of whatever this drug is?
Well, that's the irony here, Your Honor. Sodium thiopental is in shortage, and I can guarantee you that if someone tried to bring it in from this importer that operates out of the back of a driving school in London and has been associated with incidents of counterfeiting, that FDA wouldn't possibly allow it to come in under the shortage provision.
One minute. I know time is short. Going back to your standing questions, if there are two states that don't have any of the drug, if there is no more importation of the drug, my understanding of what happens is the executions are not stopped. They simply proceed with some other general anesthetic at the first stage. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well, Your Honor.
And the theory of standing is that that anesthetic might be less likely to leave the possibility of felt pain than this anesthetic. Does that wrap up your standing argument?
Yeah, I think that's fully consistent with the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, Your Honor. The alternate anesthetics that would be part of the protocol are FDA-approved anesthetics.
Does the substitution or the availability of substitute mean that the injunction you seek doesn't really redress anything? Redress your
No, Your Honor, because the theory of injury is being administered an unapproved drug from a foreign unregistered facility. A declaration or an injunction that effectively prevents the importation.
What's the injury that's being redressed? That's the legal statement of the issue, but what's the injury to the person that's being redressed by prohibiting the foreign importation?
Well, that sort of drug is recognized by the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act as being inherently risky or dangerous.
Yeah, Section. You've got a person who the whole process here is designed to kill them. The way I read your argument was that the harm inflicted by the use of the unregistered drug is that it might be less effective in stopping the pain during the course of the execution. And I think you affirmed that's correct. But we don't know what drug they would be using instead, so how do we know that there is a redress? Or we don't know they use any drug instead. How do we know that there is a redress by the injunction you're asking for?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, Your Honor, the possibility of being administered, injected with this unapproved foreign drug from an unregistered facility would be precluded by the injunction.
Yeah,
so
that,
certainly
that possibility of being injected, if it's only an insult, then you may not have standing. Judge Ginsburg is asking the question, and it's the same one I'm phrasing perhaps poorly, but what is it that happens to the person that you say is a cognizable harm that can be redressed by the injunction you seek? And I understand that to be that they would be an ineffective or less effective anesthetic at the first stage so that there would be a greater danger of feeling pain. In other words, the redress would be they would use some other drug. It would be more likely to stop the pain. Is that the correct statement?
It is correct in part, Your Honor, that the possibility of excruciating pain through anesthesia awareness is certainly part and parcel of the claim of injury. But related to that, and slightly more fundamentally, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is predicated on the notion that a drug is not safe unless it has gone through the approval process. That's Section 355E. And we don't have to rely on that alone. Foreign drugs are much more dangerous than unapproved drugs. That the FDA has said through the 2004 HHS report, the sources we cite at JA 17 to 19, and an unapproved foreign drug from an unregistered source is the worst of the worst of the worst. The whole point of the
red... You have to get to a particular harm that is redressed by this injunction.
Right,
and just the theoretical possibility that you will have a drug that isn't properly approved, if it doesn't do anything bad, may not be enough to get you there.
Right.
And that's why I'm wondering if your focus isn't on the pain, as you say, which is part and parcel.
Well,
but isn't that not only part and parcel? Isn't that essential to your case?
I'm not meaning to resist you on this, Your Honor, because clearly that is a fundamental part of the standing argument here, but I don't think we're limited to that.
I'm not really getting the rest of the standing argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I'm not really getting the rest of the standing argument, quite frankly.
Let me try and turn it around and put it a little bit differently. Every single case that we have been able to identify in which standing has been considered in the context of exposure under the food and drug laws to a substance that is unapproved or otherwise not violent or not in compliance with the provisions of the statute, every single one of those cases is found standing.
Did any of those involve somebody who's going to be dead immediately after the administration of the drug anyway?
Well, I don't...
With or without the drug.
Well, that goes to efficacy, doesn't it, rather than safety?
Yeah.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to make two quick points. One relates to the 1962 amendments, and I think that it's instructive, and just to make clear, before the 1962 amendments, the sentence that's currently at issue, the third sentence, what is now the third sentence, was the same. So the, you know, counsel's argument of how it interacts with the second sentence, either he has to be saying that the meaning of the third sentence changed, even though that sentence wasn't amended in 1962, or he has to be saying that it was understood all along to compel FDA, once it became aware of violations, to take action, but the statute concededly never required FDA to do anything at all before 1962. So that would be my response on that. With respect to the warning notice provision that was discussed, 381G, that's another good example of a congressional recognition of a personal import policy. It would be strange to enact a statute that says you have to give people these notices when you're telling them things about the drugs that they're importing, when if your presumption was that every time that you thought that the drugs were violating the statute, you were
you were actually taking action and refusing admission and sending those drugs back to the importer or destroying them. And so that provision actually underscores our point. It does not say you have new discretion that you didn't have before. It's predicated on FDA taking certain actions with respect to personal use. Unless there are any further questions.
I just want to make sure I follow your point about the addition of sentence number two. So you're saying if counsel for the plaintiffs is correct here, then either two changed the meaning of three, or three had contemplated great discretion.
Well, no. What I'm saying is either two changed the meaning of three, or he can't rely on two, and he has to say three contemplated no discretion, because that's what he's saying now, even when there was no two, which seems quite implausible.
But inserting a procedure in sentence two might very well change the significance of sentence three.
Well, it could conceivably, but I guess if you're trying to tie the language of three to the language of two.
Lord Nelson at the Battle of Copenhagen, and you put your spyglass to your blind eye, right? And then the next command says, henceforth, never put your spyglass to your blind eye. Then the original order, not to fire until signal, has more meaning, right? So the insertion of the new instruction has given teeth to the pre-existing instruction.
I'm not saying that it's impossible. I guess the point that I'm making is, if your question is, when Congress enacted this statute in 1938, did Congress intend that whenever the facts existed in the world such that FDA could make a determination, FDA had to take action? The answer, it seems to us, is no. And then the question would be, did this new statute, which was, as counsel pointed out, enacted in connection with a requirement that everyone register, and was sort of for the first time requiring certain registration, did that so change the way that the scheme operated that it eliminated all discretion in the category of cases?
Well, it eliminates the blind eye, doesn't it?
It eliminates something that might make you become aware of violations. The question of whether that also eliminates the discretion when you become aware of potentially violations. And unless there are further questions.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.